y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of murder, suicide, and drug addiction. Listener discretion is advised.
Sandy Maloney was expected in court in February of 1998 for her final hearing in her divorce from her husband, John Maloney. She had spoken with her mother several times the night before, and after being concerned for her daughter, Lola promised that she would make the just over two-hour drive from Madison, Wisconsin to Green Bay, Wisconsin the next morning to check on her. When Lola arrived, she found her daughter's body burned, not only on the sofa, but into it. After months of investigating her husband, a local police officer was accused and convicted of her murder. However, he has always maintained his innocence, and it's entirely possible that he is not responsible for Sandy's death.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear it from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
Okay, you guys, we've got a real... I wouldn't call it a whodunit, but... There's some parts where the math ain't mathin'.
It's a real diddy do it.
That's the one. Yep. Yeah. And as always, we have a couple thank yous here. We want to give a hey girl thanks to, and of course, I can't see it where I am, Catherine L. Kurowski for requesting it.
Yes. Thank you. And thank you to Beth for writing it up.
Thanks, guys. All right, so should we just like launch right into it?
I think we should.
All right. So Sandra Maloney, who went by Sandy, was born on July 30th, 1957 to Ramona. She went by Lola Beal and Laverne Cater in Madison, Wisconsin. Did I say that right?
I have no idea.
Wisconsiners.
Wisconsin.
Sandy had two brothers, Bill and Brad, and a sister named Wendy. Sandy eventually moved to Green Bay, Wisconsin, where she graduated from Preble High School. In 1976, sure. She married her high school sweetheart, John Maloney, in 1978 at St. Bernard's Catholic Church. The couple had three sons, Matt, Sean, and Aaron. And Sandy was described as warm, caring, compassionate, and a loving mother. She loved her children and her family. She enjoyed volunteering at the school that her children attended. And according to John, the first 7 years of their marriage were bliss. Now, we don't have, obviously, unfortunately, Sandy's account of the marriage here. John says that Sandy was working as a secretary. John was trying to finish up his criminal justice degree, and then he eventually joined the police force. According to a 2005 CB News article by Rebecca Lung.
Nope, CBS.
What did I say?
You said CB.
Just CB. Okay.
Like a CB radio, but we're CBSing.
Yeah, my brain saw the S and said, no. Not going to do it. I'm not going to say three whole letters. Okay. According to a 2005 CBS News article by Rebecca Lung, the couple's eldest son, Matt, said that the family started to crumble in the early 1990s. So Sandy at this time had developed a neck pain and she was having a lot of trouble getting it treated. What I read from some different articles and some other things were her neck was causing a lot of pain for her. And for whatever reason, doctors couldn't figure out exactly what it was. She was trying chiropractic care that didn't seem to be helping. It might've been making it worse, like all these things. So she's having trouble getting a diagnosis. She doesn't know exactly what's causing it. But in the meantime, she's still in incredible pain. And this is something we just talked about in our doc jam, Take Care of Maya. Like, it seems like patients who suffer from chronic pain a lot of times are, I'm not going to say all the time, there's great doctors out there, but have a higher likelihood of not being believed, especially if you don't know exactly what it is that's causing it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that was the case with Sandy. She was given some different prescriptions to try to deal with the pain, but it didn't seem to be helping. And so then she just started to develop tolerance. I don't know, but she ended up with an addiction to prescription painkillers. And not only that, she started drinking really heavily too. And you have to have so much compassion for that because she's just trying to stop the pain initially.
Right.
And then what those substances do to your brain, now she becomes dependent on them and all the things. So that's when things started to go really downhill. According to John and the boys saw it. And also Sandy's friends saw it. She just became a person that they did not know anymore, which is unfortunate and it's sad. So Matt said if she couldn't get the pills from her doctors, her friends would provide it for her. They were no help to her. And I think initially, maybe, with these friends, they were like, she's in a lot of pain. I want to help her. I don't think they realized how detrimental that was to her. I think initially they were just trying to be of help. And I don't know what caused those friendships to crumble, but over time, she became very, very isolated. And the addiction was so bad that if her sons needed a prescription, the local pharmacist would make them take the pill in front of him to ensure that Sandy would not take it. And from what I understand, I mean, they're not giving kids Percocets. Like, it was a situation that was so bad that Sandy would just take whatever she could from people that knew her. That's what they say. So it wouldn't have necessarily even been a medication that, like, it would have been a pain pill. It's just whatever they got, she wanted to take it. And Matt said that didn't work. So the pharmacist would say, here's your prescription. You need to take it right now. I want to see you take it because you need this. I want to make sure you get it. And so he said that before they'd even go in, because now Sandy knows this is going to happen, she would tell him, put the pill under your tongue. And when we get out, I'll take it. And that's what they would do. You know, and these are kids and they're listening to their mom. I mean, it's just, it's really sad, the whole thing.
So sad.
Hey y'all, this episode is proudly brought to you by Lola V, an award-winning hair care line founded by the fabulous, the one and only, Jennifer Aniston. Okay, so you guys know we are absolutely obsessed with Friends. It's like half the show already, even before this. And when we had the chance to work with a company founded by Jennifer Aniston, we were like, could we be any more excited? So Jen was sick of the same thing we all hate, right? Having to choose between hair care products that work and ones that are actually good for us. And with Lola V, that dilemma is history. I don't know about you, but I put my hair like through it. I curl it, I blow dry it, I straighten it. And I don't just do that to my own hair. I do it to my extensions too. And extensions need lots of love. But all the things we do to our hair takes a toll, right? And that's why it's crucial to have products that not only repair the look of damage, but shields your locks from future harm as well. Well, guess who just entered the chat? Lola V's best-selling products, the cult classic Glossing Detangler and Perfecting Leave-In Conditioner. And these aren't just styling products. No. They're your hair's new best friends. And if your products really love you like a bestie would, they would do things like this, okay? They would contain no silicones, no sulfates, parabens, or gluten, and of course, they would be cruelty-free and vegan. The in-shower trio of restorative shampoo and conditioner plus intensive repair treatment, that's gonna turn your shower experience into a spa-like retreat while working to banish breakage. Post-shower, the Glossing Detangler, Perfecting Leave-In, and Lightweight Hair Oil are a triple threat for your styling routine. These multifunctional formulas work beautifully together to prime, prep, and finish for silkier, shinier, Jennifer Aniston-approved hair. Okay? That's Lola V, you guys. That's your hair care bestie, okay? If your products aren't doing all of those things, they don't love you like Lola V loves you. And don't even get me started on how amazing my hair smells after I use these products. My husband just walks around and just like his nose is just like glued to my head, okay? It smells so good. Unlock Jennifer Aniston approved hair at lolav.com. As our loyal listeners, you'll get an exclusive 15% off your entire order when you use our code QUEENS at checkout. So that's 15% off your order at lolav.com with promo code QUEENS. Let me spell that for you because we don't want us going to the wrong website, okay? That is lolav, LOLAVIE.com with promo code QUEENS. Now, please note, you can only use one promo code per order. Discounts cannot be combined. After you purchase, they're going to ask you where you heard about them. And please, please, please support our show and tell them that we sent you. LolaV.com. Use our code QUEENS. Over time, Sandy also developed depression, panic disorder. Again, she was abusing alcohol as well. Matt said they would find vodka bottles hidden around the house that would prompt fights between his mom and dad. They'd be screaming, they'd be yelling, they'd be slamming doors. These were pretty, I mean, it's got to be so scary for these children.
Right.
And they, you know, they don't understand. Like, it's just, it's really sad. Now, John says he never physically abused Sandy during these fights, but there are records that Sandy complained about his violence toward her to her psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist said, I have seen the bruises. I know that there are bruises. Sandy's sons, though, said that their mom would do anything to get more drugs. So they also said, not only would she, and I don't know if what they mean by that is that she would hit herself on something to then be able to go to the doctor and be like, look, I have an injury. I need more medicine. That's kind of what that seems like he's trying to say there. Right. But he also said she was drunk all the time. I mean, she'd be drunk by the time they got home from school every day. So, right. And that's 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon kind of thing. So she'd fall. She fell all the time, they said. She would get bruises all the time from just stumbling into stuff.
Well, and one of the sons too said that he never saw John be violent towards Sandy, but Sandy was violent towards John. So
That's true. Yeah. He did say that, that he never saw his dad hit his mom, but sometimes when they would fight that Sandy would hit him. And aggression is something that can absolutely happen with drugs and alcohol. It can make you more irritable. It can make you, you know, you and I have been in massive fights when we would go out drinking.
Remember a specific situation where I got a phone thrown right into my chest.
Yeah, but I was so drunk that I thought I got the phone thrown into my chest. And I called Andrew and I was like, and he was like, well, I don't know what you're saying. And then I think I threw all your shit in my car out in the road. Maybe, I don't know.
It was totally did. Yes.
Maybe the driveway. Maybe I didn't make it all the way the road. So, and then the next morning I'm like, I don't know.
What about night?
What were we mad about? Like it just happened, right? So like, I think everybody's been in that situation where like, you know, if you've ever, you know, drank alcohol, you're just like, whoops, had a little too much, got pissed about something. Actually, don't even remember what it was. Like, you know, but they were getting in fights all the time. John would get upset that she was drinking and then that would start a fight. And like, and you have their children saying, I did see this. I saw her get really aggressive with him. I saw her hit him. I never did see him hit her. And police had been called to the Maloney residence on several occasions, but charges were never filed. You could say, well, John's a police officer, so they're not going to file anything against him. Or you could say, they didn't find any, you know, there was nothing to substantiate. I don't know. But for John, the final straw was in 1997. So Sandy was driving the family van. She was highly intoxicated. She slammed into a parked car. This is literally sounds like the scene from, is it 40-Year-Old Virgin? Where I don't remember her real name.
I can't remember her real name.
And she's
either.
Like, let's get some fucking French toast or whatever. Yeah. But it's like that. I mean, she's
Leslie
driving.
Mann?
Yes, Leslie Mann. She's driving. She's super, super intoxicated. She slams into a car and it was pretty significant. And John was like, okay, that's it. The kids could have been in that car. He was out of town at the time. So she could have been driving the kids mm-hmm. to or from school or, you know, something like that. And it was so, so bad. Her just situation was so bad and out of control that these kids knew as children to watch your mom's behavior, and if it looks like it's bad, don't get in the car with her. Like, that's a lot to, you know, that's a lot for kids to go through. It's really sad. So when that happened, he was like, that's it. I can't do this anymore. They had tried to get her to stop drinking. Some family members had been involved in these things to try to get help for her addictions. Unfortunately, it didn't work. So he kind of, I think, just threw his hands up and was like, I don't know what else to do, but I can't keep my kids in this situation. So he filed for divorce. He moved out. And then he got full custody of all three boys. After he did this, he filed for divorce. He moved out. He meets a 28-year-old IRS agent. This is Tracy Hellenbrand. And then they started dating.
On February 10th, 1998, Sandy spoke with her mom, Lola, on the phone three separate times. And the last call was in the evening and ended at about 6 p.m. During this call, Lola offered to drive to Green Bay, Wisconsin, the next day to check on her. And like we said earlier, it's about 2 hours and 15 minutes from Madison, Wisconsin to Green Bay, Wisconsin. So Lola likely hit the road fairly early as Sandy and John had their final custody hearing that morning.
Lola was so concerned about her that she was going to drive that far the next morning. Mm-hmm. And that I just feel like that's a part of the puzzle, right? Like she was
yeah.
so worried about her. And if you watch the, what is that show called? True. It's Aphrodite Jones. What was
yeah.
it?
True Crime with Aphrodite Jones.
Yeah, that might be it. She has an episode on this. When they are reenacting this phone call between Lola and
Sandy,
the actress playing Sandy is slurring her words. She's not making a lot of sense. And so, you know, Lola is offering, let me come check on you. She also knew that Sandy was really, really worried about this hearing. She did not want to go to this hearing. it wasn't going to go well for her.
Right.
None of the divorce stuff had gone well for her. I mean, you know, so I just think that that is important. It adds context that she was so worried about her that she was going to drive, get up early that morning to make it to Sandy's house to check on her before the hearing.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So when Lola arrived at Sandy's house on the morning of February 11th, she found the side door was locked. And this was unusual because Sandy usually kept that door unlocked. But Lola goes to the front door and found it was like a storm door, glass door. The latch was broken and she had tied, it looked like a little plastic tie that she would keep it latched to. And that was shut. And that was normal. So Lola goes inside. As she made her way inside the house, everything seemed off and she didn't see Sandy. So she goes upstairs, she's calling Sandy's name. She doesn't get a response. She goes back downstairs and she finally found Sandy. Sandy was lying face down on the couch and her body was completely burned. Lola ran outside to her car where she called 911. And within minutes, police and firefighters were on the scene. And while all this is happening, John Maloney is at the hearing. And then he goes home in the hopes of finding out why Sandy did not show up. It does not take long for John to find out, though. Police go over to John's house to break the news of Sandy's death. And the officers that showed up were his colleagues. And when they told him what had happened, John broke down. While the officers were with John, his girlfriend, Tracy, she shows up. And he told her what happened. And as far as we know, Tracy was very, very supportive. She was there for him while he was very upset.
They, in the, like, these police officers, you know how so many times you'll hear that, like, oh, well, when we told him she was dead, he had no reaction. It didn't seem real, or, you know, or it was too much of a reaction. It seemed put on. Like, these police officers felt that he responded appropriately, and they thought that Tracy comforting him was also appropriate. Right. And seemed genuine, like genuinely seemed like they did not know that she was dead.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and you can take that for what it's worth, but initially that's what they thought.
Yeah.
When a man loves a woman, he installs Simply Safe because he wants her to be real safe.
Oh.
It was a reach, maybe, right? I don't know.
I think it's a little, but it works.
Thank you. I tried.
Mm-hmm.
It is a little sexist, too, because you don't have to be a man who loves a woman. You can be anything you want to be, and you can still install Simply Safe. But the point is, yeah, if you love someone, you want them to be safe, and there's no safe like Simply Safe, and that's why we recommend it. It's an advanced system that protects every inch of your home. And backed by 24/7 with live professional monitoring for fast emergency response for less than $1 a day. And here is why we love it.
I mean, you guys, Simply Safe is phenomenal. It's so easy to install. Even me, a woman who loves me, a woman, can install it.
Yes.
By yourself, right? And it puts your little mind right to ease, okay?
Yes.
Like, you can listen to more true crime while you're home alone and not be scared.
Yay!
That's priceless, right?
Yes, it is.
And Simply Safe is trusted by the experts. It was named Best Home Security Systems of 2024 by U.S. News & World Report. Simply Safe offers everything you need for whole home protection. HD cameras for indoors and outdoors, advanced motion sensors and entry sensors to protect doors, windows, and rooms, and a collection of hazard sensors that detect fire, flooding, and more. Simply Safe is powered by 24/7 professional monitoring, so whenever your home is threatened, trained agents spring into action for emergency dispatch and response. And that's all for under $1 a day.
Ugh. Amazing.
Okay. Under $1 a day. The system is so easy to set up by yourself without any special tools or know-how required. And if you don't want to do it yourself, that's no problem. You can get one of their expert technicians to come to your house and install it for you. Plus, with the 60-day risk-free trial, if you don't love your system, you can return it for a full refund. Simply Safe even covers return shipping.
Oh, we love it. Order now to get 20% off any new Simply Safe system with Fast Protect monitoring. Don't wait. Visit simplysafe.com/killerqueens. That's simplysafe, simplysafe.com/killerqueens. There's no safe like Simply Safe. John was described as a typical cop wanting to put the bad guys away, and he was known for getting angry and aggressive with the quote-unquote bad guys, but he was also described as being a devoted father. He was also chosen for specialized training in the spring prior to Sandy's death as an arson investigator. So back at Sandy's house, investigators found that the couch in the living room was destroyed by the fire, with one side being more burned than the other. Sandy's entire back was burned, and her head and torso were found on the less burned side of the couch. She was also not wearing a shirt. And as investigators looked through the home, they found cigarette butts, matches, and empty vodka bottles in and around the couch. At this point, police suggest that Sandy's death was an accident and that she had fallen asleep with a lit cigarette in her mouth. Dr. Gregory Schmunk was the chief medical examiner for Brown County at the time and said that this was one of the most problematic cases that he's ever been involved with. When it was time for the autopsy, Dr. Schmunk was out of town. So Dr. John Tegatz, too. I don't know how to pronounce Tegatz.
Sure.
Tegatz from Milwaukee County stepped in. And during the autopsy, beneath the layers of her burned body, a small amount of soot was found in Sandy's lungs, but the carbon dioxide level was only at 8%, which meant that her cause of death was not the fire. As he continued with the autopsy, Dr. Tegatz found a large gash at the top or on the top of Sandy's head, as well as marks on her neck that indicated strangulation. Because of this, her death was ruled as being caused by probable, quote unquote, probable strangulation. So this doesn't automatically mean that her cause of death was murder. Probable cause is not 100%.
Yeah. I have here, too, a little bit more detail about this autopsy. Mm-hmm. So like they said, the carbon dioxide level was only at 8%. So they did not believe that smoke inhalation
was the cause of
her death. They did find those marks that appeared to present as strangulation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she had that
gash on her head.
Her blood alcohol level at the time of her death was 0.25%. And we'll link to this report too. This is Dr. Dibdins. I do that every time. A forensic pathologist. So her blood alcohol level was 0.25% at the time of her death. That is not lethal. The prosecution is going to harp on that, but that's not lethal. But her vitreous alcohol level was 0.40%. It all kind of plays a part. The medical examiner also did not have any, at the time of this report, had no information about Sandy's history. He did not know that she was a really, really heavy drinker. He did not know that she had a habit of lighting cigarettes and then putting them all over the house, falling asleep. He did not know that she had a habit of, her son said that she had a habit of like taking tissues.
Kleenexes and stuff. Uh-huh. Yeah. And twisting them up to get the sleep out of the corner of your eye or something.
Yeah. Like the goopy crap out of her eyes and stuff like that. So like all of these things they did not have. And she was found face down. So these are just all things that are going to come into play as we continue.
Well, and one of the things too that I found to be really interesting that they brought up was the fact that she was shirtless. Like she, you know, she was topless. And they indicate to what I got, we'll just keep going because I'm in classic Tory form. I'm trying to get ahead of myself. So after receiving the autopsy report, though, police quickly changed Sandy's manner of death from accidental to homicide. They then immediately started to look at John as their number one suspect, right? Like the husband did it. Because John was a police officer, Special Prosecutor Joe Paulus was called in. And he was known as Hollywood Joe in the media because he loved himself a high-profile case and he never lost.
Shouldn't that be a red flag as a prosecutor if you never lose?
one would think.
Because you're going to lose cases sometimes. That's just going to happen.
Well, yeah, you should lose cases sometimes.
You should lose cases sometimes, right? Yeah. So if you never, ever, ever lose and you are very obviously attracted to the limelight, I don't know. It just, should we never be losing cases?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that would be like, oh, this college student has never failed a test or never even missed a question on a test. Like, okay, well, right. Maybe they're cheating. Like, what? I don't know. I just,
yeah, you're right.
Like, so once humans make mistakes, I don't know.
Well, except for Paulus. Once Paulus took over the investigation, the state fire investigator Greg Egham and his team were asked to take a closer look at the crime scene. Egham said that it was an odd crime scene and the doors to the house were shut and locked. There was no oxygen to feed the fire that was contained to the couch. And he said that the windows were all closed. And if the glass had shattered on any of them, the entire house would have gone up in flames. But because no oxygen was present to fuel that fire, it stayed just contained to the couch.
And also, okay, so what are we thinking here? Obviously, they now think that John Maloney killed Sandy.
Right.
And that he started a fire to conceal the murder, right? They just want to make it look like a tragic accident. And then they list all of these things that are going to be like, we'll see, we'll see, we'll see, because I found this and I found that and I found this. Yet none of those things contributed to the fire.
But the thing is, they act like they're like, God, you know, he's an arson investigator. So he's really, really, he would be great at making this look like an accident. Or it was an accident.
Right. Like, is it possibly a coincidence that he got arson training and then his soon-to-be ex-wife dies in a fire? Yes. Should we take a closer look at that? Yes.
Because if he was so good at making it look like an accident,
then the whole house would have gone down.
Wouldn't he have been better at it?
I would think. Because he, of all people who would know, you know, I'm stupid. I don't know much about fires. So like, if I was like, I'm going to set this fire to cover all this shit up, I would not think to open the windows. I would not think to do that.
I wouldn't think to do that either. But I do know from like candles that if you got a candle burning you put the cover on it, it's going to go out.
Yeah, you suffocate it out, basically. Yeah. But would I think about that in the moment? No.
No.
An arson investigator, though, would know that this fire is going to burn out.
Totally.
If I only light it in one very particular area. This one little thing has been lit. I've lit nothing else around the whole house to ensure that the whole house goes down.
See, that's another big point. And again, like, I feel like we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but it's hard not to because, let's keep going. See, now I'm, okay. So when Egham was searching the couch, he found a number of matchbooks stuck inside pillows and a hat with a full book of matches inside. He also found two unburnt tissues twisted up and stuck in the couch cushions, which we mentioned she was known to do that. He also found a pattern burnt into the rug that went from the coffee table to the couch, which he believes suggested that an accelerant was used.
And their whole big deal with, see, look at all these matchbooks all over in the couch. They weren't lit. They were just simply not lit. All those tissues that they said were twisted and looked like wicks, like something somebody would have all light. This one, I'll light this. It wasn't lit.
No, the fire is just right the F over here. And all of these other things are inside of the couch. Wouldn't you think if you put them there to make the fire bigger, you would be like, I'll light this one, I'll light this one, I'll light this one, I'll light this one, I'll light this one. I'll light.
Right. It like, what is that one show, Little Fires Everywhere or whatever?
Oh yeah, I've read about that show.
It's really good, but...
Well, in the book, I've not read it, but there is a book.
I didn't know that. Okay, well, I want to read that. But that's kind of what they're like, see all these things that are evidence that somebody would have used to make the fire cover up this crime.
Right.
Except they didn't use any of them. Oh, and except that Sandy had a history of every single one of those things, doing it herself and then falling down and passing out. Like,
yeah.
It just, I don't understand.
Next, his team searched the basement, and what they found down there was shocking. They found blood everywhere, including footprints and blood, and they sprayed luminol, and the basement lit up like, they say, a Christmas tree. There was blood in the shower, and a bloody shirt was found in the hamper. Testing was done, and it was all found to have been Sandy's blood. When they went back upstairs to continue the investigation, they found that the phone was off the hook. They retrieved Sandy's phone records because of this and found that Sandy had been on the phone with her mom until 6:15 the night before, right? Lola called her. Then at 6:40, all incoming calls got a busy signal, which is when they believe that the phone was taken off the hook. Then around 7:30, the phone started working again, and the crime scene investigation unit came in and determined that a small mechanism in the phone melted just enough to make the connection good again. I didn't know that was possible.
I didn't either.
Because of these findings, they were able to determine that the fire had to have been burning before 7:30 p.m. and Sandy must have died between 6:30 and 7:30 that evening.
Okay, so now let's find out
why John did it.
Exactly. Is John available during 6:30 to 7:30? Is he accounted for?
Yes and no.
He is. So they talk to him again. He's got an alibi. He says he was at home with Tracy and two of his sons, Aaron and Sean. So Matt, the oldest, was at baseball practice during this time, and he had to leave at 8 o'clock that night to go pick up Matt from baseball practice. Now, he does do this. He makes it to pick up Matt from baseball practice. He's not late. You know, no coaches, no other parents say, I hung around with Matt until his dad got there. He picked him up on time.
Mm-hmm.
So Aaron told police and maintains that during this time period that he and his dad were setting up his new bunk bed. So he'd gotten a new bunk bed for his room. They're putting it together. And he's like, I was 8 years old at the time. I couldn't put that bunk bed together by myself.
And you like, wouldn't forget a big event like that. Like, if it was a run of the mill every day, like, well, I mean, I think I was watching TV. Like, you would, you might could have mixed that up, but like,
yeah,
it's well, a big enough event that you'd remember.
Exactly. And it's not like they found out their mom had died 6 months later and were like, what were you doing that night? They're going to find out the next day.
Yeah.
Remember that scene in Under the Tuscan Sun, one of the best movies ever made, where Frances tries to kill a scorpion, but it like falls into her blouse and she runs out to the balcony and takes her shirt off to get rid of it, only to realize that her neighbors were walking by at the exact same moment?
Oof. Yeah, I do.
I mean, who can forget that, right? I mean, right. Maybe you didn't memorize the movie like we did, but it did happen. And I think it's safe to say that Frances felt vulnerable in that moment, like super exposed. Okay?
Yeah.
And if you go online without using ExpressVPN, it's like being naked in front of a floor-to-ceiling window. Okay? There are creepers out there who can see and record everything you do online, even in so-called private browsing mode.
Ugh. Next time you go online in private browsing or incognito mode, look at the fine print. You'll see that your browser activity is actually visible to a ton of people, like your internet provider, your school, or even your employer. That's because when you use the Wi-Fi at work, at a hotel, Airbnb, or even at home, the owners of that Wi-Fi can also see everything you're up to. Imagine all those people getting a list of everything you've ever clicked on. Kinda worse than taking your blouse off on a balcony while your neighbors walk by, isn't it?
I would think so, yes.
And that's why I never go online without ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that sends 100% of our traffic through their encrypted servers, so our browsing history cannot be seen by anyone. It's like a super incognito mode that actually works. Plus, ExpressVPN works on all of our devices. We can use it on our phone, TV, iPad, and computer to browse, shop, watch, or download whatever we want without the whole world knowing it. Because guess what we search for? Murder shit.
Yeah.
And lots of it.
Oh, yeah. Not a good look, right?
No. If anyone saw our search history, the cops would be called for sure. And we don't want that. Mm-hmm. Enter ExpressVPN.
So make sure you protect your online activity with the VPN that we trust to keep us private. Visit expressvpn.com/queens today. That's expressvpn, E-X-P-R-E-S-S-V, ExpressVPN.com/queens to get an extra 3 months free. ExpressVPN.com/queens. So what they did the night before is imprinted in their brains. I was putting together a bunk bed and my mom was maybe burning to death. I mean, it's terrible, you know, but they're going to remember that.
Yeah.
Sean told police that he was watching TV in the living room while Aaron and John were putting the bunk bed together, and that from where he was sitting, he could see the front and back doors. And so he's like, nobody left. Nobody came in during that time. I would have seen somebody come and go, right? The police did question the boys, but neither one of them could remember specific timelines. I mean, they're 8 and 10. They're not even looking at the clock. Like, they don't, they're just like, I know that I was doing this. But so, of course, the police were just like, well, you could be wrong. You could be just saying, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Can't really trust that.
Yeah, exactly. So there's kind of a little bit of a standstill in the investigation at this point, because they have the stuff from the arson team that they believe shows that it was deliberately set and all these things, but they can't find a shred of DNA evidence or anything that actually puts John at the scene. There's nothing. There are no fingerprints. There is no hair. There's no nothing. So they decide, the prosecutor decides, I'm going to have to get information elsewhere. I'm going to have to bring somebody else in. I need to have somebody give me information. And so he decides to reach out to John's girlfriend, Tracy. So they start looking into Tracy. And remember, she works for the IRS and she's young. She's 28. So this is a big damn deal for her. She's like really, really proud of this job. And they find out that she had lied about something on her IRS application. I don't know what it was. And so they use that against her. How is this allowed?
I have no idea.
Because when you have somebody who you want to get information from and you lead with, I know that you lied on this application and I'll make sure nothing happens with that if you give me the information I want, then we're going to get whatever information you want, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, you're threatening someone with losing their job.
Right.
You're obviously going to get what you want to hear, whether it's the truth or not.
Exactly. And initially, Tracy did not budge. Like, initially, she was like, no.
We've seen this before, though, in the Innocence Files with girlfriends or partners of the suspect. And they're like, well, I mean, we could take away your kids.
Is that what you want?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I need you to tell me that he left the house before 8 o'clock that night. And if you don't, we're going to turn you in for this IRS thing. Or we won't turn you in for the IRS thing. And in fact, we'll give you immunity for that. We'll ensure that you can never be prosecuted for that. We just need to hear the truth, Tracy. I need you to tell me the truth. You need to finally tell me the truth, which is that he left before 8 o'clock that night. And so initially she's like, no, 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 no. He did not leave before 8 o'clock. He did not leave before 8 o'clock. But then a month later, she gets her immunity. And guess what? Her story is completely different now. Now she says, like before she said she'd taken one nap, which was after John had gone to pick up Matt. So he would have already left the house. This was 8 o'clock or later. And now she lays down to take a nap. It's a very late nap.
That's going to bed.
I know, right? But apparently then, like initially she had said after he got home with Matt, they got up and like went shopping or something. I'm like, where are you going shopping? Like, anyway, they had a late night. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not for me,
taking
man.
A nap at 8 o'clock is I have now gone to bed. Thank you.
Yeah.
But now she says that she has this immunity. Now everything is completely different. She took two naps that day. She took one at 7.
And then one at 8?
And then one at 8? Right. So Sandy only lived 5 minutes from John. So now if she falls asleep at 7, and fuck what the kids say. They're little kids, so they don't know what they're talking about. Because all of the kids are like, he showed up on time to pick me up from baseball. He was putting the bunk beds together with me. I was watching TV and saw the door. Nobody could have come in and out, whatever, any of that. Tracy initially says that she was up and around with them or whatever. And now that she gets immunity, she says, I took a nap at 7. And now everything the kids said that lined up with her first statement.
Yeah.
Where everything was lining up properly. Now doesn't line up. And they're like, whatever. So she says she goes to sleep at 7. They say that's plenty of time. He left. He went to Sandy's house. It's only 5 minutes away. That's plenty of time. And he could go to her house. He could kill her. He could be back by 7:45. When Tracy wakes up from her first nap, they go outside and smoke. And then what, supposedly she comes back in and fucking falls asleep again?
15 minutes late? Like, I don't...
If I'm like sick as hell, sure. I might wake up, go to the bathroom, eat something, and then go lay back down or something. But like, I don't know. Anyway. So she says they went outside and smoked, and then yeah, she goes and takes her other nap or whatever. So now that they've got this opportunity for John, because before he did not have the opportunity.
Right.
Now they've got the opportunity. They want her to wear a wire and get a confession out of John. And she agrees because she wants that immunity.
Yeah.
I just... So shortly after this, Tracy ends up telling John that she needs to move out. So they don't get the wire confession right away. She then is like, okay, I'm going to do it. But then she takes a leave of absence from her job and she moves to Vegas. And in Vegas, she's working at like, tables and stuff, I think. Yeah, she works at the casino. Obviously, she's having some reservations. I mean, she fought so hard to keep this job and now she's just gone. How does none of this make a difference? I don't know. So they decide to do the wire operation in Vegas. So Tracy calls John and says, hey, why don't you come visit me in Vegas? I miss you. Let's talk it out. Let's get back together. Like all of these things. So they're at the Lady Luck Hotel. They're set up in room 831. DA Paulus's team is in the room next door. They've got everything ready to go. So Tracy gets John in the room and then she takes an interesting approach. She's like, I know you killed Sandy. How did you do it? When did you do it? Why did you do it? And he's like, okay, what is happening here? The conversation ends up getting really heated. They're fighting. He's getting very frustrated. All of these things. And she would kind of change the subject, back off a little bit. And then once everything calmed down, she'd be like, I know you did it. Just tell me you did it. Like, I just need to know that you did it. Like, just tell me, be honest with me. Like, I don't know. I don't know exactly what she was saying, but.
Right. Yeah.
And at times, John would be screaming. He'd be running around the room. He's like pulling his hair out. He's like super frustrated. He threatened to jump out of the window and kill himself at one point. But he maintained through all of these conversations that he did not kill Sandy. He maintained that he had nothing to do with it. So the next day, Tracy has to go to work. She works at the casino while she's gone. And they've got the room like wired up. So they can see that he's searching the room for a wire and a camera or whatever, but he didn't find it. He just never found that it was in the clock radio. He missed it. So she's coming back up to the room after her shift and she stops by Paulus's room and is like, what am I doing wrong here? Like, I need some advice. Like, I don't know what to do because he's not saying anything. And they're like, why don't you like take it down a notch? Like maybe don't go in there and be like, tell me how you killed her. You know, like maybe just like ask some questions and be a little less direct. So she goes back to the room. She keeps talking to John about the same thing, which honestly, I am surprised that as a police officer and he knew he was under suspicion, why he didn't put together that she must be working with them to be only wanting to bring this up.
Well, and he got so close because he has enough suspicion to look for the camera. Mm-hmm. Maybe after he didn't find it when it was there, mm-hmm. but after he didn't find it, maybe he was like, man, this is all in my head. But
Yeah. And I mean, he loved her. He trusted her. You know, that goes a long way. But they're talking again. She's being less direct this time. And she gets him to admit that he had gone to Sandy's house, that he was there the night that she died. Now, we know that he would have been there earlier in the day because he says that he went to go impress upon her how important it was that she go to this trial or whatever, or the divorce hearing. But now he says he was there that night as well. And he saw that she was injured, but he left. He didn't do anything about it. And so Tracy is like, well, why wouldn't you have called 911 if you knew that she was injured? And he's like, well, you know, it would have looked suspicious because the call would have come from her house, whatever. And so Paulus is like, ah, we got him. Like, that's the nail in the coffin that we needed. So they arrest him right there in Vegas that afternoon. And he's charged with murder, arson, and mutilating a corpse. Hey, you guys, have you ever wondered about the backstory, like why we call our dad Miss KB? We have gotten this question so many times, we thought we'd release a little freebie for you.
So we recorded a Patreon exclusive Q&A last year, and be warned, we were outside and there was some wind, where we answered this question, and we want y'all to have the answer even if you're not a patron.
Yeah, so be sure to head to killerqueens.link/MissKB, MISSKB, and grab the audio.
And don't forget, if you want the full Q&A or access to our entire catalog of over 450 patron-only episodes with all our regular episodes ad-free, you can join the Patreon for less than 1.5 Starbucks drinks per month.
I mean, that's a good deal.
It's a steal.
It is. It's a steal. You'll get 4 episodes per week from us, all ad-free, plus anything fun we do like Q&As or literally anything else. So definitely check it out.
And not every tier includes every episode?
Yeah, we do have different tiers, so just be sure everything's listed out there when you check it out. But in the meantime, be sure to grab your free audio about Miss KB and how he came to be called that at killerqueens.link/MissKB.
John's trial took place 6 months after he was arrested. That is a fast murder trial. Joe Paulus's version of events at trial was that John was at home with Tracy and was stressed out about the following day's custody hearing. He told the jury that while Tracy napped, John slipped out into the night and made the 5-minute drive to Sandy's house to make sure that she was going to show up for the hearing, right? Sandy lets him in, and John made it clear to her how important it was that she was there. Very important. This is a big day. You can't blow it. We got to be there. But Sandy was drunk, and the two started fighting, and he snapped. Paulus told the jury that he believed that John hit Sandy, panicked, and then became extremely angry. He said that John took the phone off the hook, threw her bloody shirt in the downstairs hamper, and realized that he needed to cover up her death. So he starts the fire, he locked the side door, and then he goes back home. The footage from the Vegas trip was Paulus's whole case, the only thing that he had on John, and it aided in his theory that there were times when John was angry and volatile on tape.
Okay. Did he
see how angry he gets when somebody berates you for 27 hours?
Exactly. There are multiple hours of footage from Vegas, and they present mere minutes of it in court.
See?
I mean, any of us can look one way or another. Yeah. If you base everything off of this snapshot in time, like, you know? Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, how many bad reviews do we have based on one sentence that we said in an episode and they don't finish it? Like, come on. It's, I don't know. I'm fine with the jury watching the video, but they need to watch the whole fucking thing. You need to see the whole thing, because what is not present that the jury is seeing is the hours and hours and hours and hundreds of times that he's like, I did not do that. What are you talking about? I didn't do that. Right. I didn't do that. I didn't do that. Like,
yeah. So all of the times that he said, no, he didn't do it. That's lying. The one time that he says, oh my God, fine. I was there.
Fine. I was there. Can we end this conversation? Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he's actually telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
For John's defense, his attorney, Gerald Boyle, conceded that from the beginning that this was a case of strangulation and arson, but that John didn't kill Sandy, Tracy did. don't know why that was the approach.
Whoopsies. Yeah. What? And for the record, John did not agree with this approach.
Right.
He thought it was an accident. He always thought it was an accident. He did not think it was murder.
I wonder, though, because the manner of death was ruled as a homicide, they're not going to change it. So we can't be like, it was an accident. It was an accident. Mm-hmm. Like, if we're going with homicide, we got to pick someone else that did it.
Yeah. But I mean, honestly, it was a terrible defense. I don't think you should have used that. But
no,
there's just as much evidence that Tracy killed her as John.
Which is none.
Neither of their DNA is at the scene. You know, like, they're both accounted for by the children during this time, but that doesn't matter. So if we don't, why is Tracy telling the truth? Why is it that she took two naps? If she took a nap, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Yeah,
no,
it just,
I completely agree.
Same amount of evidence both ways.
Yeah, definitely.
Not a good track though.
Tracy took the stand. She denied any involvement. The jury of 5 men and 7 women deliberated for 11 hours. And in the end, John Maloney was found guilty on all 3 charges. First degree murder, arson, and mutilation of a corpse in February of 1999. He was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole in February of 2024.
And we're recording this, by the way, in January of 2024. So
we'll see if he gets out, which is, right. I just am appalled. The math ain't math. What, 28 years? No.
25 years?
Yeah. By 2006, John had lost several appeals, 2 of which were reviewed by the Supreme Court. And in 2006, Ira Robbins, a consultant advocate, asked the High Court to order an inquiry into statements that were made by an arson investigator at John's trial that he claimed were false. However, John's case was listed among those that the Wisconsin Supreme Court wouldn't review.
And let's remind you, the appellate system, like, the judges in these cases are often former prosecutors.
Yeah.
And in their mind and experience, their job is to uphold convictions. Not all of them. But if you come from the prosecution background, that's a W. And you don't want to change it to an L.
Like, no. What's that going to do? No.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to admit defeat. While John was fighting for his appeals, Joe Paulus was dealing with a lot of bullshit. In 2004, he was arrested and convicted for receiving $48,000 in bribes in exchange for reducing or dismissing 22 of his cases.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
22 cases. He was like doing this like bribery scheme where you paid a certain amount of money to an attorney. He gets a cut of that. And then when he goes to recommend whatever sentence he thinks should be recommended, he will say, but it's the first time. I really don't think he's a danger. Or, let's go minimum. I think minimum here.
Right.
Wow.
He pleaded guilty for all crimes and served a federal sentence of 58 months.
58
months. As well as a 2-year sentence in a prison camp. He was also required to pay back. He had to pay $48,050 in bribe money, as well as $3,087 in court assessments. His license to practice law in Wisconsin was also revoked. And as a note, we actually did talk about this in the Alex Schaefer case. This is mixtape 196.
Mm-hmm.
Because of his conviction, many people believe that something may have been done in Maloney's case as well. But
I'm sorry, but this business of finding that a prosecutor is
shadier than
corrupt
shit. Yeah.
In his job.
And that we're going to give a new trial.
Exactly. We're going to let all of these other convictions stand when we know he was taking bribes in, we know for sure, 22 cases.
Yeah.
All of those need to be reviewed. Just like Dwayne Deaver from The Staircase, when they found out that he actually had no fucking idea what he was talking about. You have to go back and review every single case that he testified in as an expert. You have to.
Guess what? I do understand that that's a lot of time and a lot of money, but how is that fair? Like, how is that justice?
Right. You know what would make you spend less time and money? Fucking making it so that they have to do their job right or they have consequences. If we believe that normal people, civilians, that the threat of jail is enough of a consequence, that the threat of a speeding ticket is enough of a consequence, our whole system is based on punishment, why do they not get any?
Mm-hmm.
You need to be afraid that if you do some shit like that, you're going to have to pay all the money back. Maybe, I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't have the money to do it, but still, maybe then you're responsible for the cost that is incurred by reviewing these cases. Mm-hmm. Like, and you go to jail. There should be jail time for that.
Well, he did go to jail for 20
years. Well, yeah, but exactly. And like, if you can go to jail for a false police report because it uses resources and it uses all these things and you need to have a consequence for that, then why are we giving these people a slap on the wrist?
Don't ask me.
Man, it's frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So is John Maloney guilty? There are a lot of people who don't think so. And this includes their John and Sandy's three sons, Matt, Sean, and Aaron. They all believe that their mother's death was an accident. And when asked about, you know, well, he kind of confessed, right? He said he was there. What do you think about that? I mean, they said the same thing. He just wanted that conversation to be done. And he often did this, they said, with his mom, where they'd be in a fight. It would be going on and on and on and on. And then finally, he'd say whatever he needed to say to get it over with, right?
Right.
Like, okay, fine.
Have you ever, I think there's got to be, everyone in the world has been in this situation before where it's like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, can we just be done with this?
Especially when you're talking to someone who it feels like you're talking to a brick wall at that point, because you know that no matter what you say and no matter what you do, you're not going to get through to them.
Right.
I do this with my kids all the time. They'll be like, Mom, what does this word mean? And I'm like, it means this. They're like, no, it doesn't. I'm like, yes, it does.
Okay,
no,
fine.
Yeah. And then finally I'm like, okay, it doesn't mean that. Okay, fine. Whatever. Like, why did you ask me? But you know, it's like that when you've got somebody, and especially when he's having these conversations or arguments with Sandy, she's not sober
right.
in any way, shape, or form. She's very, very not sober. That's not a time that you're going to have somebody be able to think about something logically or really reason and be like, okay, yeah, I see that from your perspective now, or, you know, like whatever. It's
yeah,
it's just 100%. Not going to go anywhere. So you finally just want to be like, okay, just whatever you say, you know, like the boys believe that Sandy passed out, that she had a lit cigarette like she often did, and she passed out. And remember those tissues that they found being twisted in the couch, and they said, these are wicks that whoever created the wicks just forgot to light. Like you said, her sons said she kept those twisted up in the couch all the time, get her eye boogies.
I understand. We all get them. That's fine. That just grosses me out. Like, that's
keeping them in the couch for that. I don't see where I would keep them. Maybe your pocket. But anyway, that's what she did. So another person that is convinced of John's innocence is Sheila Berry, the founder of Truth in Justice. And she's spent a lot of years and a lot of her own money looking into this case. And she found a lot of inconsistencies and firmly believes Sandy's death was an accident and not a murder. So she found some pretty critical evidence that the jury never saw. Pull over. If you're driving, pull over.
Uh-huh.
You're going to throw everything out the window. There's nothing you can do about it. It's just going to happen. Remember, there was blood found in the basement. But police also found two VCRs stacked on top of a coffee table, and then right above that, hanging from the ceiling, was a cord from a conduit pipe. And the autopsy report revealed that Sandy was highly intoxicated that night. Remember, she had marks on her neck where they said she was probably strangled. So what Sheila believes and what many people believe is that Sandy had tried to hang herself with the electrical cord, but when she jumped off the stack of VCR, she ended up falling and she hit her head on the coffee table. Then she tried to clean herself up in the basement shower, which would explain the blood found in the basement, and then that shirt in the hamper. After her attempt to clean up, she goes back upstairs where she lit a cigarette and then she passed out. And that's what caused the fire. Police also found, and this has nothing to do with the case, so don't worry about it. Police also found several suicide notes in the garbage can on the first floor. There were 5 notes in total that the police found. And one read, quote, "John, how could you throw everything away? Take care of the kids. I'm done fighting." These notes were labeled as, quote, apparent suicide notes on the evidence list, but were never shown to the jury at John's trial. Nor the possibility that her death was quite possibly an attempted suicide. None of that was introduced. This is why my question is, did the defense have this information?
Well, that's
did John
what I'm
know about this information?
Right. Because one would think if he had known about it, or if his defense attorney had known about it, then there is the direction that you're going.
And that introduces reasonable doubt instead of being like, I don't know, Tracy did it.
Right.
Like, I just cannot imagine that a defense attorney who had this information would have gone with Tracy did it.
Well, it worked for the prosecution.
Exactly. If they didn't have it, then you've got a Brady violation right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean,
and
other
there's
lawyers,
a new trial.
And there's a new trial. Like, possibly. Like, I'm sure, I know John has other lawyers now and stuff like that. I would assume that if this information wasn't shared, that they would have already filed something like that. It's possible that the defense attorney knew about it and said, I think I'm just going to go with the Tracy did it thing.
In all my years of lawyering, I don't understand.
Right. And his attorney said, because they were like, why would you go with that? And he's like, well, if I went in front of this jury and said this was an accidental death, now that would have been malpractice. That would have been insufficient counsel or whatever. What is the, why am I forgetting the name of it?
I don't know.
When you're, what you can file if your attorney didn't do a good job representing you.
Right.
Wow. I know.
I literally cannot remember.
So then remember, if she'd fallen and hit her head, why was there no blood found upstairs? They found all this blood all over the basement, on towels, on Sandy's shirt, but none of these items had John's DNA on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sheila worked with several experts while investigating this case, and they believe that Sandy ultimately died of alcohol poisoning. And so if you read Dr. Dibden's report, he talks about the fact that this blood alcohol level that she had would not have been immediately fatal. But what could have happened is that it was very high. She passes out face down on the couch. Now she's not even getting appropriate oxygen anyway. But her respiratory rate and her heart rate have slowed because of the alcohol in her system. Mm-hmm. And so eventually she dies. That's why she has a little bit of soot in her airway. But she doesn't have a whole lot because eventually she just ceased to breathe and have a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And he says also the carbon monoxide could have done that as well from the fire. But the thing is, while she's still living, essentially, she's still processing, like she's still having a heartbeat and her respiratory is still going,
mm-hmm.
albeit very shallowly, probably. Her body continues to process out some of the alcohol and some of the carbon dioxide. So that lowers the rate, or that lowers the amount that they find by the time that she's dead, but it still contributed to her death.
Right.
She was essentially in what he called it an irreversible, lethal, he called it some kind of a coma. And
yes.
Of course, now I forget the name of the coma. But essentially, her body was just in this state where she was going to die if she mm-hmm. didn't get help, and nobody knew that she was in that situation. John says, you know, that he, again, never believed that it was murder by anybody. He always thought it was an accident. He really went round and round with his attorney about it, but his attorney went with what he wanted to go with. And he couldn't afford a new attorney at that point. I mean, he's in jail, you know. The case has been reviewed by a state-appointed attorney, Stephen Meyer. And when he looked at it, he was like, again, this is an internal investigation, essentially, because the state of Wisconsin is who prosecuted him anyway. So now the state of Wisconsin is going to take a look and see if they did anything wrong. And the state of Wisconsin found that the state of Wisconsin did a great job.
Great.
Yeah. And like we said, at this point, he is still incarcerated. He's up for parole in February of this year. We will keep an eye on that and see what happens. I don't know that he'll get parole because as of right now, he maintains his innocence. And if you get up there and say, I didn't do this, they're going to say, you're not sorry enough.
Right. You have to show remorse and you have to admit guilt.
Yeah. There is a petition on change.org for this being a wrongful conviction. If you feel so moved, you can certainly sign it. If you think that he is guilty, then, you know, of course you don't have to. So, but that's it, you guys.
I just do not, a big fat do not understand how this happens. How people, and you know what? I bring her up all the time, even though I can't stand her. Casey Anthony. And she wasn't convicted.
No, she wasn't. And I know that the state doesn't have to prove motive, but the motive don't motive to me. Because John was already in a position to get what he wanted. Now, I know he was going to have to pay some alimony, at least for a certain period of time, which he did not want to do because Sandy wasn't working. But I don't know. He wanted her to be at that hearing so badly that he was like, Sandy, you got to be there. You got to be there. She'd been delaying these proceedings for quite some time because she did not want a divorce. And he was like, you've got to be there. You've got, like, please just get this done. Let's get this done. Let's get this done. Well, she didn't show up that day. So that's going to delay it even further.
Right.
Oh. Why would he go over there and kill her if he had gone over there to be like, please come tomorrow. Please just get this done. All right. Well, thank you guys for watching and listening. And we will catch you on the next episode. Let us know what you think in the comments. Love you.
Bye.
Bye. All right, you guys. It is shout out time.
Shout out time.
Can't like do that with my own voice.
Well, I think you did a great job.
Oh, thank you. All right, you guys know it's like the best time ever because we get to thank you for supporting us. And like we're all best friends.
Yay! Best friends that will fuck your name right up.
Oh, big time, big time. Ready for that?
Hey, yes.
Hey girl, thanks to Geneva Lear,
Tabitha,
Chelsea H,
Bianca,
Lynn,
Cody Harrelson,
Bethany Jung,
Sally,
Imogen,
Catherine,
Sally. Wow, two Sally.
Oh. Courtney H.
Yeah, like, oh wow. Like just we've not had two Sallys in the same shout out.
I know.
Deja Bivens,
Jasmine,
Daniela Acevedo,
Katie Bricker,
Rachel Huseman,
Taylor,
Michaela Harrell,
Courtney, Caparello.
Kaylee Sudret,
Megan,
Casey Fry,
Barbara Wing,
Zoe Workman,
Peyton Hoskins,
Chelsea,
Nancy,
Izzy T,
Ellie Grace,
Kimberlyn Smith,
Sam,
and Ashley O'Rourke.
Yay!
Thank you guys so much. We love you, love you.
Yes!
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation. Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye!
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud. Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.